Morning. And as we start things out, I have to say that visiting Betty and Mary together in, I will always call it Covington Commons, but five star, I suppose, was one of the most fun things that you could do. The stories you would hear of World War II and building the radios, and it was amazing how an afternoon could fly by. So my heart is warmed with memories of both those ladies today. And one more thing, if you have time this week to write a card or give some encouragement, we had a service for Charlene Hoke yesterday in Bippus. Got to go to Bippus for the first time. They have a stop sign now, so they're growing. But what was supposed to be a small graveside service, I think we had 70 probably there. The cars just kept coming. And we had a great service to remember Charlene, but I can only imagine for Floyd this is a difficult week. And so if you have an opportunity or if the Lord puts them on your heart, a card or a call, some type of encouragement for our brother in Christ would be, I think, appropriate. All right, so as we get started this morning, we hear the word blessing a lot, don't we? Or we hear people claiming to be blessed a lot. And it comes in a lot of ways, but I think it all has a similar trend. This time of year, we have athletics happening. We've got lots of sports, and you'll hear athletes that'll say after they win a game, or maybe when the NBA championship is all done and they're holding the trophy, they'll say, "I'm so blessed. We're so blessed. Because we won the game, we won the championship, we won the award." You hear it from movie stars, from musicians as they go through their award ceremony. You'll hear it from students as they're standing giving their address as valedictorian for graduation. It's this idea that I've been given so much, I have so much, I've been so blessed. You'll see it, and Beth talked about the Grand Canyon. It was funny, when we were at the Grand Canyon, you saw people that were outside of that nice, like, railed-in area that we were in, on a boulder with nothing behind them, just constantly backing up, holding their phone to take that perfect picture with the sunset behind them and, you know, this beautiful location. So they could put up on social media with hashtag blessed. That they can be there, or maybe it's the mountains, or it's the ocean. But it's these pictures that we put out that, again, hopefully they represent the fact that we really were having a fantastic time. I do think it's funny when you're at some of those locations, you see this smile and all of this perfectly crafted picture, and then you see the couple just bickering and fighting. So the idea out there is life is so wonderful, but then you watch and you're like, is it so great? But we see that and like, oh, I'm so blessed. Look what I get to eat. Look where I get to be. Friend who gets a promotion. I'm so blessed. I just got this raise or this promotion at work. And we use this language of blessing. But today in our text, Jesus, it's going to stretch us a little bit on what does it mean to be blessed. We have the capstone on the Beatitudes, and then we're going to get into next week this idea of salt and light as we continue through the Sermon on the Mount. But the final Beatitudes, twice, as Jesus gives the capstone or the end of this Beatitude passage, it's often called in theological terms a golden chain, or we've been referring it to as a ladder. You have to climb the rungs. You can't just start at the end. It's not a bag of Skittles or M&Ms where we pick the ones we like. They build upon each other. The last two are on the idea of persecution. And to the first century audience, to Jesus' audience at the time, the idea of blessed are the persecuted would have had a lot of murmuring. Even the disciples, hearing this idea of blessed are the persecuted, had to have turned to each other and said, John, did you hear that right? Blessed are the persecuted. Remember, if we study the book of Job, what was the response of Job's friends when life got hard? Well, what did you do, Job? How did you earn this hardship? Remember, the Pharisees and even the disciples went to Jesus and said, this man who is crippled, was it his sin or was it his parents' sin that caused this to happen? And Jesus' response was, no, it was an opportunity for God to show His glory. But Jesus is giving us a new narrative. How often have you heard somebody say, I am so blessed, right after they break their arm? Even little Jeffrey, when he broke his arm, didn't say, Dad, I'm so blessed, broke my arm. Or what about when you lose your job? Or what about when you lose a job because the owner of the company doesn't like Christians very much? And he knows that that's who you are. Just this week, one of our children went to, she was invited down to the courthouse for not a demonstration or a rally, but I guess a little bit of a counter-protest to all of the pro-choice activity that was happening there. And they just wanted to stand up with their friends and say, there are some of us who believe in life as well. No nasty signs, no angry rhetoric, no yelling, but just to stand there across the street. And her daughter was surprised to see how many of her friends who were in choir with her and other activities that were there holding signs of coat hangers and other graphic images. Just so angry. We live in a world where just being Christian, just having the values and the views the Bible teaches, could very well bring persecution. And so are we blessed when we're persecuted? Jesus says we are. So we're going to dive into that a little deeper today. Before we get to persecution, though, we have the beatitude, blessed are the peacemakers. Matthew 5:9, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. So what Jesus says here is that God's children are peaceful. That's kind of how you can flip that around. This shouldn't surprise us because Jesus is peaceful. We see in His temptation, after His 40 days of fasting in the wilderness, He's tempted by the devil. And in the devil's temptation, He says, couldn't you just call upon the angels and the scriptures say they will attend to your every need? Don't you have these powerful allies that will take care of whatever's bothering you? And it's an interesting contrast because Jesus could. He could have called these angels and they would have taken care of Lucifer right there in the temptation. But Jesus was patient through it and even peaceful during His own tempting. We see Jesus peaceful with those Pharisees that were awfully difficult.
The ones that ridiculed.
How easy it would have been for Jesus to call upon those angels to just eliminate the annoying Pharisee, the difficult Pharisee who was speaking out against Him.
Or maybe it was the
bully He grew up with in Galilee who said as Jesus was teaching, isn't that the carpenter's son? Where Jesus ends up saying a prophet is not respected in his hometown. Or maybe it would be the chief priest who before the crucifixion was ordering the beating of Jesus, brutal and merciless. Jesus could have, with one word, called upon angels to come and eliminate the problem. And beyond that, we see the power of Jesus' words over life and over death. The Roman soldiers, as they crucify them, one word from Jesus' mouth, and they would have received a very violent end. or even the crowds who stood around the cross and hurled insults. In those very dramatic and difficult circumstances, Jesus received the abuse, and yet His tremendous power, He didn't react or respond with violence. Jesus was peaceful. And as Christians, as ones who carry the likeness of Jesus, we too are called to be peaceful. And yes, even in the heart and light of persecution. So what does this mean? Well, there are a couple of things. One, and I think to me this is a minor one, but peace here, especially if we look at the words used for peace here, are not only meant to be in your interpersonal life. So there were some who would teach like, well, Jesus is only talking about peace in your relationships. Really, this is like capital letter P, peace. Christians are peaceful. And I think that this has to have a little bit of an effect. It has to seep in to our perspective on war and nationalism and other things. God's people are peaceful. Wish I could fill in all the blanks, but I think that's something we have to chew on. Does it mean that a Christian can't serve in the army? I don't necessarily believe that way. But I did a lot of interviews of World War II soldiers, and it was amazing to hear the stories of some of the Christian soldiers who chose to take more of a route of pacifism. And they became medics in the Pacific. And if you think being a medic in the Pacific was safe, you've got another thing coming, because these guys were targeted first. And they didn't care. So we have to wrestle with that. Again, I don't have conclusions, but this is not peace just in our relationships. This is the peace that pushes everywhere. And Jesus grew up in a time of great empire under the Roman Empire. The people of Israel knew something about war and about violence. And Jesus is saying, my kingdom is not one that expands through force and power and violence. There is no coercion. No one is forced to enter my kingdom. Instead, my kingdom is one that rolls out with peace. And the kingdom of God expands as we surrender our will and our heart to the heart and will of God the Father and Jesus His Son. So this idea of peace, I think a quick caveat, like I said, about the idea of peace and war, but even more so, where can we work this into our daily life? Very few of us have to deal with the idea of conflict and war on a daily basis. What we do deal with are relationships. And the biggest threat to the church doesn't come from the outside. In every church I've been in, the biggest threat has always come from the inside, and it's conflict and quarreling between believers. As Jesus prayed the prayer of unity, the idea was that the world would be able to see and know that God was God because of the unity that He had with the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And the church would resemble God because of the unity that believers would have with each other. It is a powerful testimony to the world when they see that Christians can get along. And it's a powerful picture of hypocrisy to the world when they see us having deep-seated conflict with one another. And I tell you what, I have seen quarrels in the church like none I've seen outside. Anger about how a memorial fund was spent. About how... we'll get into all of the specifics. Especially because some of them might be from here. But when Christians reconcile, when they make peace with one another, something amazing happens. It's no mystery to many of you that my history at Anthony Wayne Church has gone back a little ways. Pastor now, and I'm blessed to have been mentored under Jerry when I was youth pastor before. Had some really good years here during that time. But even before that, I was a teenager here. My first Sunday, I think, was one of Pastor Dunn's last Sundays that he was here. And I came and I was part of the youth group that wasn't real big at the time. And then I actually received my call to ministry, and it was Pastor Carl who was here that really helped me delve into what that meant. And there was Pastor Dave and Pastor Carl. And some of you know that during that time, Pastor Carl's tenure didn't come to a real clean and happy end. I was the young teen in the congregational meeting that pretty much, I think, told the board they were going to hell because I was unhappy with how things were being handled. And again, as like a 15-year-old or 16-year-old, I took a side. Learned a lot since then. But when I came back, and really it was a professor in college who said, "Jeff, I've got somebody I want you to work with." I had been a part of a lot of church conflict and division and split. But he said, "This is a pastor, he's a good friend of mine that has helped heal churches he's come back to." And sure enough, it was Jerry. And then I heard the name of the church and I was like, "I don't know if that's going to work." And Beth and I, literally, we were together at the time. I'd not married yet because we got married here. But we prayed about it and I said, "Well, you know what? I'll be the big person and I'll let God shut that door." Because I was convinced there's no way that God's actually calling us back there. But he did. And it was a little awkward at first. There was a little bit of kind of getting to know things, but I will tell you that after some of the first board meetings, when some of those leaders who were in the congregational meeting, these are leaders that I pretty much said, "You're all going to hell," came to me with tears in their eyes, embraced me and asked forgiveness for what had happened back then. It took what had been a hard and stony place in my heart and it melted it. To this day, I can't imagine what it would be like in life if God had not given me the opportunity to see what was a place of hardness and pain softened and reconciled when the power of forgiveness was applied to it. See, this is why it's so powerful for us to be peacemakers. Because there are these pain points, there are these places of hurt, and in the church, it's a powerful testimony to the power of God when we can forgive and reconcile and make peace with one another. And the inverse of the Beatitudes may be harder than the Beatitudes themselves. We've talked about this with a few others. But what are the implications of the inverse here? So God says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be children of God." So what are those who don't make peace? Well, if you are unable to make peace, I think it brings up serious question as to whether we have fully experienced adoption into the kingdom. To whether we have that title, son or daughter of God. Doesn't mean we can't get there. But if you are walking around with a list of enemies, and I have met people who have a list of enemies, and they can pull it out of their wallet or their purse, and they're ready to add a new name when something happens. If that's you, I'm not here to condemn you this morning. But God's got work to do because it's blessed are the peacemakers because they will be children of God. If you can't make peace, if you're unable to make peace, there's work to do. Your spirit needs help. So again, one of the hardest things may not be the way they're stated, but what are the implications of the opposite? Second beatitude this morning is, "Blessed are the persecuted." Matthew chapter 5, verse 10, "Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Again, we're not talking here about being persecuted for our own stupidity. That's not what the text says. There is a Martin Shekel who was in the news a few years ago, and he's actually in the news again this week, which is what brought him to mind. Now, Martin was a young executive, and he rose to fame, well, maybe infamy is the better word, when he had a small drug company, and they went and bought really cheap medicines that were off patent. And he took these medicines, found a way to protect them once again. These were medicines that you would have bought for a dollar, or maybe at Walmart they were free. And he said, well, why don't we raise the price on these 100 at points, even 1,000 times over? And there was this big uproar as a lot of people couldn't afford, and insurance companies were struggling with the idea of taking a drug that was once cheap and making it very expensive. And Martin's defense was one of smugness and laughter. In fact, it got even worse because he would show off the things that he would spend money on. And again, I'm not judging, but maybe I'm judging a little bit. They looked like the kind of things that somebody as a gangster on the street would have invested in. It was like the rights to have his own Wu-Tang song wrapped about him. It was these really expensive jewelry and things that he'd wear out in public. And the response in the press and the media was not positive. He was persecuted. But he was persecuted because he was foolish. In fact, I think the newspapers had one title where they claimed that he had a very punchable face. It's not good. You don't want to be somebody who's got a punchable face, right? So we can be persecuted for a lot of reasons. Jesus isn't talking about blessings that come from persecution because we decide to be bad actors in the community, because we decide to be selfish and smug. No. He's talking about persecution because of our righteousness, because of the good things we do. And I love the picture. We're going to get into this next week with the idea of salt and light. But righteousness is compared to this idea of light. And if you have light and darkness, light always reveals what's in the darkness. Darkness is never able to overtake light. In fact, if you have a very, very dark place, if you are in a cave, and I used to like caves, but now they make me a little claustrophobic. I can do Mammoth Cave where it's like wide open, but when I have to start, you know, on my belly through the narrow tunnels, there's a serious concern that I might die there and never come back, get stuck and not be able to get out. But even in these dark caves, I've been in some very, very dark caves. You would think in such incredible darkness, I would need a very bright light. But the opposite is true. A very dim light, a very small light can illuminate the darkness in a very dark place. A bright light can be almost blinding as our eyes have adjusted, as we've gotten used to that darkness. The truth is, if we have righteous acts, if we are living a Christ-like life, then we will become light, and that light will bleed into all the darkness around us. And there's something about light that's revealing. And if you're living in darkness, that light can be uncomfortable, it can be threatening. One of the things I learned as a very young man is you don't go buy a car at night. Because at night, the moonlight can kind of make that car look really, really beautiful. And there are cars that I've looked at night that I was excited about, and I went back during the day, and you're like, oh my. A lot more dings and dents and things than I realized. At night, it looked fantastic. But as the light of day shined down upon it, you saw all the flaws. And as Christians, when we live righteous lives and we are around other brothers and sisters, sometimes in the church, our righteousness can make even other brothers and sisters uncomfortable. But in the world, in the workplace, it does. There's an old trope that we see from police procedurals, the police dramas, movies, TV shows. There's this idea that some police may be corrupt and accept bribes. But it's not enough in any of those stories for their partner or the other officers to simply give it a blind eye. It becomes obsessive that they take part in the bribe too. In the world we live in, your righteousness will make those who are living fleshly, carnal lives uncomfortable, and it will bring persecution. There's just no way around it. While I was studying for this whole series, there's a quote that's come up a couple of times, and I've really chewed on it. I think it's one for us to chew on too. And the quote that stuck with me is, the label persecuted church is redundant. There's only one kind of church, and it's persecuted. So if you are unpersecuted, if the church isn't receiving any persecution at all, if there's no pushing from the side, if there's no disagreement with what we teach, then we may not be the church. Because throughout the teachings of Jesus, this idea of the church being persecuted, that if you walk the path that Jesus walked, you will be persecuted, that's evident. And we can't have our cake and eat it too. We can't believe the truth and profess to be a follower of Jesus, as we'll talk about even in our final beatitude, and say, well, no persecution for me. If we are salt and light, if we are being righteous and doing those things, then there will be those who will be offended by it. There will be those who will not like that light shining upon them. And you will be persecuted. That persecution can be as minor as harsh words and criticism. The scriptures make it clear that there will come a point where that persecution might look more like violence and martyrdom against us. For Jesus' original crowd, it was very true. For the disciples, there were many of them who gave their lives as martyrs because of what they believed. And finally, Jesus capstones, he makes his point even firmer when he changes the stance a little bit and he goes from blessed are thee to blessed are you. He makes it personal when he says in verse 11, blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So Jesus is making his point very strong here. He said, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness. And then he turns and he says to them, to the entire crowd, blessed are you. He's making it clear that this chain, this ladder, this is not about other people. This is about them. And blessed will they be as followers of Jesus when they are hurled insults upon them, when they are persecuted, when they are falsely accused of all kinds of evil, when they are insulted. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in that. This is not the destination many of us hope for when we climb a ladder, when we go down a path. First ones maybe we get excited about. Well, maybe not being blessed to be poor in spirit, but blessed are the meek, maybe I can handle that. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. That sounds fantastic. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. But as we work our way through the Beatitudes, as we surrender our heart, as we become aware of our spiritual poverty, and there is a deep sense of humility and repentance, as we mourn our sin, as we show mercy, as we hunger and thirst for righteousness, as we have purity of heart and make peace with others, the end destination is persecution. So what I can promise you is, if you live the way that Jesus called you to live, I can't promise you money, I can't promise you health, I can't promise you prosperity like anything else the world looks at. But I can promise you that you will be able to take your place alongside Jesus and the rest of the saints, and you will be persecuted. It's a promise. If you're doing this thing right, you will be persecuted. It doesn't mean that it's only persecution all the time. It doesn't mean that you will be martyred for your faith. But it does mean that we shouldn't be surprised. Because if they did this to Jesus, the most pure and holy and wonderful life this planet's ever seen. If they've done this throughout history to the saints, and if you want an opportunity to be encouraged, one of the books that I have on my shelf that I flip through anytime I'm ready to say, woe is me, God, I have it so bad, I flip through Fox's Book of Martyrs. And I hear stories of some of the saints from the Old or the New Testament, some of the apostles and their stories, but even throughout history, all the way up until the present, as brothers and sisters in Christ have given their very lives to follow Jesus. So church, there is the terminology persecuted church is redundant, because if we are the church, we will be persecuted. That's baked in. It's part of it. And I wish I could tell you, you accept Jesus today, all your problems go away, everything becomes easy, and the world will just think you're amazing. But that's not the promise that Jesus gives. Blessed are you. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you, they're going to persecute us. And I don't know, again, what this will look like in your life exactly. But I'm keeping my eye around the world. And it looks like persecution might become more and more of a reality in darker and darker ways for the church. Again, I'm pulling from the headlines, and so I'm not trying to make too much of contemporary issues. But many of you heard that there was a Christian counseling center. They do a lot more than pro-life counseling, but that was one of the things they did in Wisconsin. And they had a Molotov cocktail thrown through the window. And thankfully, politicians have even said, well, that's wrong. Can't burn buildings down. So I was glad to hear that. But this week I heard a recording, and I couldn't even listen to all of it. I think it was about 3 hours long. And these are the messages that people who were from the pro-choice side of the political aisle, I guess, had left. And when I heard that there were messages left, there was actually a part of me that hoped it would have been one of those unifying moments where people would say, even though I disagree with you, I'm really sorry this happened, thoughts and prayers and all of those things. But that's not what it was at all. It's 3 hours of some of the most vile things I've ever heard a person say to another person. Things like, well, next time I hope you're in the building when it burns down and you go to hell. And just statement after statement of such anger and such malice. And this is just a Christian counseling center. And it was so targeted towards the Scriptures and the beliefs of the Scriptures. We're entering a world where the rhetoric might get harder and harder, where the language might get harsher and harsher. And while I'm not in a hurry to become a martyr, if you are, that's a whole other challenge. I like my life and I love my family. We have to be prepared for persecution. And if the day comes, even here in the great United States of America, where worshiping Jesus becomes a crime, are we willing to take the punishment? Because blessed are those persecuted. Blessed are you when people insult and curse and say all sorts of terrible things about you because of Jesus.